Well, we measured time basically from 1965, which we say was a year of the revolt. That changed the level of the struggle and the texture of the struggle. We have a calendar, a seven-year calendar. 1965 was a year of the revolt. 1966 was a year of Black Power. 1967 was a year of the Young Lion. That's the year of politics. This is the year that Black people became more politicized by the issues and became more involved, because we believe that in order to build a nation, you have to mobilize, organize, and then nationalize. And one of the processes in there is to politicize people so they can take a position on things, so that they can feel the need for power, so that they can get three basic things: self-determination, self-respect, and self-defense. I think this year has brought them to that point. And 1969 will be the year of Reconstruction, to pull all this together so that we can make some sense and meaning out of it.
Jumbo, good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm William Grease with Lou House, welcoming you to another edition of Black Journal. Well, tonight we're going to look at 1969. President Nixon is now occupying the White House that has brought so much prosperity to white America. For almost 200 years, the black man has looked to the White House with hope that the incoming presidents would represent all Americans. A few days ago, President Nixon took office. He got there without our help. According to present statistics, only 10% of the black vote was cast for Nixon. One of the reasons may be due to the fact that many of us have lost faith in existing American politics. To the black man, American democracy has often been dangerously close to fascism. Over the past few hundred years, many of us have seen too many of our leaders jailed and killed. Most of us didn't vote for Nixon simply because, well, we didn't dig him. As it stands today, three Negroes have accepted positions with the Nixon administration. None of these positions are of cabinet rank. It has been reported and admitted by the Nixon administration that many black politicians have been offered positions in the Nixon administration, including Senator Brooke of Massachusetts. Even those men politically oriented toward the White House have declined to serve the new president. One of President Nixon's major campaign promises that played a large part in his election was his pledge to bring law and order to America, obviously appealing to the frightened middle class, a category to which few blacks belong. Although black America has not been talking to Mr. Nixon, we've been talking about him because he represents America and will influence a great deal of what is going to happen in this country in the next 4 years. Tonight, Black Journal will explore some of the reactions of Afro-Americans across the country to President Nixon. We'll also be discussing community control, black economics, and our evolving political consciousness.
I second the nomination for this party's candidate for President of the United States, a strong, sensitive, capable, qualified black American.
Channing Phillips became the first Afro-American to be nominated for president. But 1968 was not a year in which the black man won any real political victories.
I'm the presidential nominee of the Peace and Freedom Party, but it's only the visionaries within the party who think that we're going to have a president in the White House this time around.
As a presidential candidate, and a candidate who's been legally on the ballot in the state of Pennsylvania for 5 months, I took it as a direct insult that the President of the United States did not offer to brief me as he have offered to brief the white candidates. So I had no alternative but to fly to Paris and talk to the North Vietnamese delegation myself.
We do not want a police state, but we need a state of law and order.
Watch your head,
if I were the president, I'd maintain law and order in Washington. If I had to put 30,000 troops, one every 5 foot apart, with a 3 foot bayonet, armed with carbines and everything else necessary, and you could walk on the streets.
Our founders recognized that the first requisite of progress is order. Now, there is no quarrel between progress and order, because neither can exist without the other. So let us have order in America, not the order that suppresses dissent and discourages change, but the order which guarantees the right to dissent and provides the basis for peaceful change. Time is running out for the merchants of crime and corruption in American society. The wave of crime is not going to be the wave of the future in the United States of America.
There wasn't much difference, really, between Wallace and Nixon and Humphrey. Slight differences of degree, but essentially all of them were catering to what they felt was a new feeling of anti-black in the community. So I don't think Nixon is going to do a whole lot that Humphrey wouldn't have done.
Well, I think it's the law and order issue, and the fact that Nixon was voted into the presidency as an indication of the general conservatism of the country. But also, I think the general feeling that to deal with a lot of the problems we have, the social problems, the urban crisis, the ghettos, and so on, is to use repression and control. That is, that somehow this can all be handled if the militant black folks are controlled and contained and even perhaps maybe eliminated. I think that's going on in a lot of people's mind.
Initially, I was a little disappointed that Nixon did get elected. But on the other hand, as I said, I do think that society, in order to function well, needs to be structured, and there have to be laws. And I believe that the type of government that Nixon's proposing has some opportunity in trying to control and direct the processes that are going on. I don't believe that all this can be accomplished by force or by police power, but I don't believe that Nixon feels this way either.
I think that the significant thing about Nixon's election, of course, it means that the iron-like grip, the stranglehold that the white liberal establishment has had on the black community for these last 20, 30 years has finally been broken with the election of Richard Nixon. And I think that we are going to have to really fend for ourselves. I mean, I think a lot of the people in the Afro-American community have been running around screaming about black controller communities, black this and black that. They're not going to have a lot of handful of guilt-stricken white liberals hanging around to turn on. I mean, they're going to be dealing now with white America at its worst. And they're not going to be able to pull this kind of hustle of, you know, screaming black power and at the same time taking whitey's money. Because I don't think that Richard Nixon is going to be getting up off of that kind of guilt money from the white community.
We are now not playing anymore. There's no time left to play. And that we are probably in for several years of a great repression from the new powers that be. Not that they are so different from the others, but there will not be, I hesitate to repeat Watts, but I don't expect there to be a lot of guilt money and conscience money around. I believe that the whites in the United States are getting themselves together and that we'd better do the same.
So you don't really see any, that we have any really strong allies. I'm thinking actually of Robert Kennedy. Would you say that he was a strong ally?
He was a potential ally. Yeah. I think in the case of Robert Kennedy and people like him, they have been misled by the liberal Negro faction that exists in the Afro-American community. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that when he talked to quote the so-called pseudo-militants, that he felt that he was really talking to the soul brother, you know, 125th Street and Lenox Avenue, who's got the do-rag on, you know, he's ready to burn America down. Well, nothing was farther from the truth. Well, I think that perhaps that Kennedy could have been a potential ally, but I don't think he was a real ally at the time of his death.
Nationally, we see that they're taking these steps from Kennedy, say, to Nixon is a, you know, a giant step to the right, especially, as he says, economically, it's going to mean where, you know, a lot of those social illusions that the Democrats spout are going to be just summarily cut out. But it was interesting to see that black people, especially in Newark, who are trying to keep Wallace out of the White House, let Imperiale, who's on the other side of Wallace, in their house. You know what I mean? Right on a local level. And like he says, the grassroots white man has already taken his step.
And we're in a situation that's very analogous, although people don't want to face this fact, with Germany, where the people that rule the country, the class that rules the country, interprets all of the problems of the country as being the fault of black people. Black people are going to begin to become the scapegoat for all of the problems of this society. And what that means is that there's going to be a new white political tradition which has come out in Newark, where you see, they say there's some little comfort that Wallace wasn't elected, but little local races were elected all around the country. Right.
They don't want to be a colony in a nation. They want the pride and the self-respect and the dignity that can only come if they have an equal chance to own their own homes, to own their own businesses, to be managers and executives as well as workers, to have a piece of the action in the exciting ventures of private enterprise.
Well, it's just a game. Nixon, the thing about Nixon is he's talking in terms of black capitalism, but it will not reach the man in the street. It will be the black bourgeoisie who will benefit more by it than the man on the street. And I don't think Nixon is going to bring about any drastic changes. I think we have to be aware of Nixon, the old Nixon. I don't think he's changed. I think Nixon is the same person in the McCarthy era. And we, as blacks, have to be aware that they do have concentration camps in America, and they will be open again, and it won't be for the Japanese people this trip.
And I think Nixon will do good things for black people, not because he wanted to, because black people will put so much pressure onto him until he have no other choice.
Now, what I think we must understand is that there is no political solution within the context of this political system. There may be a political solution through some modifications of this system, but within the existing political system, for a number of reasons, gerrymandering, for the question of the seniority system in the House, the question of the way in which the existing political structure changes the rules. When the people were organizing in Lowndes County and there was a threat of blacks taking over, they changed the rules. Where an office was formerly 2 years, they extended it to 4 years. Where it cost $550 to file for office, they raised that to $500. I mean, the system changes the rules of the game. And if we are naive enough to believe that simply by following those rules, which is in fact our 400-year history of following those rules, that if we, that by continuing to do that, and they changed those rules upon every whim, then we're a lost and defeated people.
We use the ballot along with all the other things that available to the arsenal of black people. And we use the ballot specifically for one purpose, and that was to educate people to the real nature of their problems and to give the people who wanted to vote an opportunity to vote for the Black Panthers. But I think, I know in SNCC it was recognized as an educational process, process of development, of raising the political consciousness of people to the point that they can see that voting is not to a solution. It's not a solution. Black people voted and put a black mayor in Cleveland. Now, what's the situation in Huff? What's the difference? That's not the solution. The solution is very massive changes, and you do not get massive changes by the simple process of voting, because you do not control the electoral process.
We wish to offer a nomination, the wave of the future. We offer a nomination with the greatest pleasure, the name of Julian Bond. Yeah!
I'm not about, by myself or even with the help of the other black legislators, going to revolutionize Georgia. If I thought I was, or if I told my constituents I was, I'd be kidding them, I'd be kidding myself. The other thing I know is that I can, and I have, been of service to the people who sent me there. I've done things for them.
We found with the presidential campaign situation that there is a limit, and I speak to you as a political scientist, there is a limit to the extent that black people can use the electoral process to effect change, that unless we do amass our power, as Dick Hatcher, Mayor Hatcher says, get ourselves together, we cannot expect anything from the electoral system.
I think that there is some indication that it's possible to change the system. I think that the restructuring of the Democratic Party, for example, the Democratic National Convention, which saw a number of changes made there, the thrust on the part of many people in that party since the elections, indicating that they want to change the nature of the party, is, I believe, an indication of hope that the system can be changed rather than to destroy it.
Well, I think they've begun to take that first, you know, like, step toward organizing their own thing. And everything done inside the system now is, like, experimental. Julian Barnes is one of the last great experiments, you know. If he wins, you know, if he can achieve what they seem, if he can work out of blackness within all that whiteness, then it might hold things back a little bit in terms of really coming together for black people.
We cannot make alliances with our enemy. The best thing we can do is make a coalition, and that must be a deceptive move. The difference between a coalition and an alliance is that a coalition is a temporary arrangement on a given issue. Once it is finished, it is dissolved. An alliance is a permanent relation for, you know, defense and development. And we can only do that with people of color as opposed to the colorless. And some people were trying to make alliances with their enemy and at the same time had no power to make an alliance. You cannot make an alliance if you have no power and someone else has all the power, all the technique, and give you the direction. Don't you know this has been tried in the integration movement? There is no difference. To talk about making an alliance with white people with guns is just like making an alliance with white people during a nonviolent stage. The white people are slick enough to understand that people are not going for nonviolence anymore. And what they're trying to do, they used to have nonviolence and integration. Now they got violence and integration. It's the same thing. It's the same cardboard Murphy game, the P game that every nigga should be hip to by now. And if the white man can no longer rule, we say, from the airfield, he'll start trying to rule from the bedroom. And anybody that goes for that is a chump. A 450-year-old chump. So then 1970, we're going to separate all that.
See, I think that if we learn that we can depend on Big Daddy in Washington and begin to get together, I think that 1969 could be the beginning of a new unity, of a new power, of a new cooperation across the society of black people and poor people and people of goodwill.
I have to be perfectly honest with you. I can't see, you know, that silver lining in the cloud. I want to struggle in that direction. But I say my concern is who's going to interpret this law, and who's going to enforce it in the Nixon administration?
Well, my conviction continues to be that the selfish self-interest of this country does not lie in the direction of racial conflict. That it is possible, I believe, for people who have convictions to move this country in the direction of some new opportunities and to begin to relieve some of these critical problems.
On the political scene, recently reinstated Congressman Adam Clayton Powell has issued a call for a third political party. Powell says militant blacks should unite behind Julian Bond, while white radicals line up behind Ted Kennedy. Powell says a third party led by Bond and Kennedy may be necessary to, quote, save the republic. In Orangeburg, South Carolina last February, three students died when police fired into crowds of students demonstrating to desegregate a bowling alley. The Justice Department has filed charges against nine of those policemen for their actions. They face a meager sentence of 1 year in prison and a $10,000 fine if convicted. After 10 months of patrol duty in Wilmington, Delaware's black community, the National Guard is pulling out. Assigned to the city during rebellions sparked by Martin Luther King's death, new Governor Russell Peterson ordered the troops out as his first official act. The guard was the most glaring symbol of repression in beleaguered Wilmington's black community. Black Panther National Chairman Bobby Seale announced that his organization was getting rid of conspirators and opportunists that had infiltrated the Panthers. He said that members engaged in criminal activity would be expelled. Roy Wilkins, executive director of the NAACP, has come out opposing autonomous black studies departments, one of the key points in black student rebellions on campuses across the country. He claims that such departments would result in Jim Crow schools and that he would be willing to go to court to prevent such a move. On the other hand, Roy Innes of the Congress of Racial Equality has branded Wilkins as passé and supports the students' demands for autonomy. Black Journal has invited Mr. Innes and Mr. Wilkins to debate these issues on our February program. Now for a broader look at the school situation, here is Lou House.
With Hawkins dropping us some dew, I'm on the case here in front of the Founders Library at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Some comments about self-determination. Well, self-determination in our own black communities, controlling our economic growth, our educational system. Black folks have got together and talked with one another about womanhood and manhood. All these things came to a head in 1968. We saw what happened in Ocean Hill, Bronzeville, in New York, and in Boston at the Martin Luther King Elementary School, in Philadelphia, and here in Washington, D.C., and in Chicago, and in almost every other black community across the nation it's happened. It's happened at universities like San Francisco State, Brandeis University, Columbia, New York, Cheney State in Pennsylvania, and Northwestern in Illinois. It revealed itself with the formation of black student unions at places like Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and almost every other major university in the country. That's what's been happening across our country. And blacks are demanding and they're determined to take control of what people teach them and what is relevant to them in our black culture. That's what we're about in 1969.
What is the disorderly conduct? I want to know. So what is the reason why I'm being arrested? What am I being arrested for? I have a right to know before you move me. What am I being arrested for, Mr. Clark? Because I want to know. I don't have to leave me for that. Is the policeman here to arrest me? Who's my arresting officer? You're my arresting officer? What am I being arrested for? Let the public know what.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say, say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart, remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me, then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live.
I think community control is a very big issue. But it depends on whose community is controlling what. You see, the thing that we've been faced with, and we certainly have community control in our systems today, but it depends on whose community is doing the controlling.
Well, New York City's ghetto areas has had a history of academic failure. Youngsters have just not been able to break through the educational structure of New York, and I suspect that you can find much documentation to some of the, shall I call them, administrative reasons. For example, they have not had in most of these schools the experienced leadership. They have had tremendous turnovers of staff. Most of your inexperienced teachers who enter the New York City school system come into the ghetto areas. And finally, you've had a complete lack of confidence by the parents in the school system, and have created in the minds of the educators a sense of apathy. You know, parents just don't care. It's not so. They just don't have any confidence, and they've seen the failure year after year. You have a centralized system, for example, that gives a test every year, year after year, to record the same degree of failure. In other words, the kid fails in the third grade, he gets the test in the fourth grade, he fails it in the fourth grade, they give it to him in the fifth. Just completely reinforcing the failure, and this then defeats the youngster. With no real, shall I say, processes of addressing themselves to this kind of academic retardation.
And we also found in the Brooklyn school situation that as we do get ourselves together, we are going to come up against some very strong, traditionally entrenched forces like the unions. And we're just going to have to be prepared on an organized basis to deal with those kinds of forces.
Yeah, well, it's always that battle, you know. White folks give you money, and they you know, they want to be on the board of directors so they can start setting policy and start telling you what to do. We said, no, you know, this is our thing. We're going to do it our way.
Well, it's clear to me that the problems that the various groups have had around the country in various cities is due to the fact that the way community control has been achieved in its limited fashion has been on the basis of a privilege granted to the people by powerful and sensitive people, let's say. And the concept of community control as a right, an inherent right, has not been clearly established. And I think until it is established that this is a right and not a privilege, and this is not an experiment, but the people exercising their rights, until that is clearly stated by the courts and sanctioned by the same, then it's not going to be successful. You can't continue to hold school behind the barricades.
At San Francisco State College, the Black Student Union joined with the Third World Liberation Front in a student strike. Their demands include a permanent Black Studies department to be headed by Dr. Nathan Heer with the rank of full professor. They are demanding that blacks determine the curriculum for the black students. In short, that they control their own destiny.
And what we're going to do, we're going to hold the fort. We're going to go to jail if necessary until the silent white minority, you know, who aren't against black folks, who love black folks, but who never do anything but sit on their rear ends, and they're never prepared to make any real contribution in man's age-old struggle against tyranny. So we're going to hold the fort until the silent, immobile faculty at San Francisco State College recognizes that these young militants are attempting to save the soul of a great institution.
As I know, even though I could be biased, but I've been all over the country, and I think that this is the vanguard group. And they have managed to pull a new thing, which is to get the bourgeois-oriented community involved, indeed the white liberal community, and even the white conservative, many of the white conservative community representatives involved in the struggle. This is being pushed at the present time. And yet in the same, they still retain their blackness and their pluralistic perspective, just as any other black power group.
A lot of times you find on the Negro college campuses that the students are being held down harder than they were on these predominantly white campuses, because they're usually able to get a strong sense of collective effort when they're isolated on the white campuses, and they move stronger, whereas on the Negro campuses, and I went to Howard, the administration is so Tomish, you know, that they go out of their way, like at Howard, you know, where Neybert, who we once looked up to, they go out of their way to suppress, you know, so that you'll see we can appear on white campuses for a black student union actually more quickly than we can appear at a, you know, at a Negro college, you know, for our own people. I mean, it took more, I think, effort to get us at Shaw and Howard. In fact, I went to Howard one time and they wouldn't even let me speak in the auditorium. We finally had to go out on the campus and speak in front of the School of Religion because they closed all the doors, you know. And they're so, the Negroes, a lot of times, are so paranoid that the white people are going to get them or something, you know what I mean? That they're worse, actually, the Negro administrators turn out a lot of times to be,
worse,
you know,
white,
yeah, worse than the white administrators.
Well, I was in the vanguard, I was there early in this movement. I went there in 61 at Howard with the intention of the very same thing which is happening now. And first being rejected for 3 years by the students because they couldn't understand. And then when things changed in society at large and black power and all that, then the students began to move, at least express an intention in that direction. That brought about a clamping down by the administrators. So it seems to be an impossibility because the students themselves get sort of comfortable in the sort of spirit of blackness there, which you find. You don't confront the white people daily. You're in your own group mainly. And you have all the soul food, the soulness, and the dancing, the music, and you don't have this daily confrontation. If John Jones gets a better break than you, it's because he's John Jones, or because he's more well-to-do, or because he's in a fraternity of some sort. But at a white college, if John Jones gets the break, he got it because he's white to the black student in many cases. So it is daily confrontation. It's daily commuting from the black community to the college. White college campus gives a daily sense of discrepancy between these two worlds, and so other things being equal, that alone would cause the black students at the white college to be more aware of their fate and their situation and to be impelled to do more about it.
I think the student movement has to be looked at very closely by black adults to know which direction we are going to go in, because the students are going to move. Because if I'm not mistaken, that is the basis and nucleus of our very strong group that is moving in this country right now, the Black Panthers.
As a matter of fact, the founder of the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton, started as a college student at Merritt campus, moving to get Afro-American history on the curriculum of that college. At this point, now in 1968, Merritt College has a black studies program, and you can get a degree in that. This is where Huey began actively in his black nationalist activities on the coast. But in terms of the black student movement, you have to go much further than that, back to 1960 in Greenville, North Carolina, where the first sit-in began. And this is the beginning of the whole overt protest movement in this country. It began with black students. The Black Panther Party in Lowndes County, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, black students, the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, black students. And wherever you look, the real impetus of change has come out of the youth who were in school and who were in a position to sit back and analyze some of the things that were going on and were willing to take action. What's so significant now is it's not the college students only that are moving, but it's all the way down to junior high and even elementary schools. They're all moving.
Black Journal has learned that WCBS-TV and Columbia University have agreed to the demands of the Black Advisory Committee of the new educational series, Black Heritage. As a result of their agreement, the committee now controls the content of the programs and the selling of all books that may be published relating to the series. In addition, agreement has been reached for wider press coverage through a black public relations agency and the use of a black cameraman on the series. In sports, Roy Campanella has been elected to baseball's Hall of Fame. O.J. Simpson has been named Sportsman of the Year by Sport Magazine. Lou Alcindor was cited as the top performer in college basketball, and Arthur Ashe as the top performer in tennis. We extend our congratulations to all four. 1968 was a busy year for the Black Theater, and this year promises more of the same. The New York community can currently choose from such plays as To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, a composite of Lorraine Hansberry's work, Big Time Buck White, which recently arrived from Watts,
Ed Bullen's play In the Wine Time at the New Lafayette Theater, and the Negro Ensemble Company's God is a Guess What. There's a growth of cooperatives in a number of black communities across the country. The latest of these are located in East Harlem. A furniture store and meat market are being financed and operated by East Harlem residents. For more, here's Lou House.
President Nixon has proposed several plans which he claims will assist the Afro-American to get a piece of the action. And one of these plans is to give tax incentive to white industrialists for turning the so-called hardcore unemployed. That's us on the IBM cards in those low-income areas, you know. It's quite obvious that the white man will profit from this venture. Now, what remains to be seen is whether we will. And another one of the plans is the president calls it black capitalism. They call it that. It's become part of a large portion of our discussions in the black community. Black capitalism, brothers and sisters. But I think we're talking about our own schemes, and we're talking from a different viewpoint to get our thing together.
This boycott of an Oakland supermarket was supported by the Black Panthers. Their leader, Huey Newton.
Aggression in the economical area is as real as aggression physically by the racist police that occupy our community as a foreign troop occupies territory.
I think it's been very clear throughout our history that there is no interest or any policy or any effort on the part of the power structure to share the resources of this country with the oppressed black people. So therefore, if the black people must have these resources, then they must take them.
Do you think that some of the things that this establishment is throwing out at you, such as black capitalism, is
everything the establishment throws out is to protect the interests of the establishment, period.
But you political use power. Don't yeah. throw, yeah. you know, I mean, yeah. black capitalism scares me to death. See, because all I see is black pawns stepping on top of poor people rather than the Jews who dominate the ghetto or the Syrians who dominate, you know, or the other minority groups. There's just a shift of power at the base. I think what this country needs, and frankly, I can't even think in revolutionary terms because I can think in them, but when I think in them, well, I can't talk in them because I got better sense than to see that I just don't see any possibility of revolution right at this moment. And so I'd rather quit talking about revolution and talk about what is possible. And what is possible is to take something like black capitalism, and if people know what they're doing, build a base for economic control of their neighborhoods so that they can affect the police power, they can affect basic decisions. You get best way to get rid of the police problem is the way we did in Selma. We got him out of office. And or the way you did in Tuskegee, you put a black sheriff in.
This is a country with 6% of the world's population that controls 60% of the world's resources. It's international capitalism. The way in which it came to power was through taking the land of the Indians and using black people to develop the land. There's no people for us to exploit except ourselves. We cannot go down the road that white capitalism went down. We are not producers, and the only way in which you could get into that position is if, in fact, the federal government gave us billions of dollars to become producers, and you went to the point that of the 20 congressional committees, 13 are run by Southern Crackers, and of the 16 senatorial committees, Senate committees, 10 are run by Southern Crackers. So white racist power stands in the way of this kind of solution.
Well, see, this is the mistake of a lot of people. We already have a lot of money within the black communities, and the disappointing thing is that black people have never utilized the monies and power that they already have. And what we're saying is that if we can utilize what we already have, because we're great buyers, we like high-quality things, if we can utilize this power, then we can develop it into more power.
We've talked for 20 years. We tried to get Cadillac to allow black people to sell Cadillacs to black people. But just think of it. We are 10 or 11% of the population. We were buying about 22% of the new Cadillacs, 30% of the old Cadillacs, used Cadillacs, and we couldn't even sell these cars to our people.
In 1955, we were behind curtains in some southern cities. So just to have the privilege to sit middleways the bus was progress. Then we got to the front of the bus. The next question was driving the bus. The next one was being an executive at the bus company. And now the question, which is a black power question, is why, if we do not have, since we have the most customers, can't we own the bus company?
The thing, all we want to do is, like, have people pick up the idea of, like, hey, yes, I can go into business. I can develop this way. I can start this factory. I think once we get the thinking going along those lines, we get a little of that Jewish thinking going, you know, because these cats, they circulate that money from brother to cousin to, you know, whatever have you.
What we are trying to do in Sunflower County is to try to start some kind of self-help project. We have so far about 50 female pigs, and these pigs are going out to 50 families. And as these female find litters of pigs, the families will give back two pigs to the pig bank, and then it will keep going until people be able to have enough meat, because, you know, kids suffer in this county from malnutrition. I'm 51 years old, and a doctor in New York told me a couple of weeks ago that I got such a shortage, I have to now have 4 oranges a day, and I have to eat raisins. I don't have iron. I don't have vitamins. And all this kind of stuff, I think it's a shame. And until we can gain some economic power along with the political power, it's just going to get worse.
Southwest Alabama Farmers Co-op is one of the many programs, and probably the only one of the many programs in the South that is completely supervised and controlled by blacks. Presently, the co-op comprised of 2,000 farm families, low-income farm families. Presently, the co-op extends over 10 counties in southwest Alabama. Our feeling is that it is the only way that the co-op could succeed and be a successful business venture, that it has to be controlled by blacks, because the whites will manipulate the system to the extent that it makes it ineffective. This too has been one of the reasons why we've had many problems from local whites.
Let me say that I am not a black capitalist. I do not consider my approach to black economic development as black capitalism. At the same time, I am not a Marxist either. I'm a black nationalist. And we talk about the acquisition of capital instrument for black people. Now, if someone want to call that black capitalism, if Nixon want to call it black capitalism, so be for him. We know what we're talking about. There are some black brothers who do consider themselves black capitalists, and that's fine for them. I would just like it to be clear that we at the Congress of Racial Equality and those of us who consider ourselves Orthodox black nationalists, do not talk and describe ourselves in Western European terms, either as Marxists or as capitalists or as communists or anything else. We are black nationalists, and we believe in the philosophy of black nationalism and the economics that flows naturally from that philosophy.
There are people running around talking about building a black automobile industry when there is no such thing in Latin America, to the best of my knowledge, with the possible exception of Argentina, where they assemble cars. And you have to ask yourself, they are separated from the United States.
They have their own currency?
Their own flags all over Africa, their own currency, their own flag, their own geographical territory, and they even now, over a lot of Africa, have control of their own political structure. And yet, they are still dependent upon the United States or its client states. So when you talk about setting up your own competitive economics against the dominant economic system, it seems to me that this is truly the world of fantasy. What must happen, I think, is that there must be an overthrow.
There's no fantasy with me. I am for beginning where we are, and we certainly are within this system. So that begin to do anything about it means that we begin within it. Now, so we begin within it, and we begin with a program. Our program is one of struggle. Our program is one of doing everything that we can to improve the position which we have while we work for fundamental and revolutionary change of the system. And besides, you will never achieve the overthrow of a system if you don't begin with the immediate demands of the people, because you will never be able to mobilize them for the overthrow of the system. Not just by waving a flag and doing some shouting. Will you organize the people for this? You will organize them in the course of developing struggles against their oppression for the things that they need, and they will clarify themselves as they go along, and then will come the great moment of total revolution.
Rave on, Reverend, but you're dreaming. Look,
okay.
Gentlemen, let me just, I think I can get this out of you in another way. Let us go around the circle here, the semicircle, and let us get a one-minute statement on the future. What does the future hold for us, Mr. Mayfield?
I think I've said it before on the program, so I'll just repeat myself. I think we are in for a period of repression. I think that white America, which Mr. Moore seems to think I overestimate in its power, but I've lived under it during my years, as has he, and I have a respect for the amount of power he has. White America is not going to tolerate but so much. Black America is in a fighting mood also, and that there is going to be more and more confrontation, and that it is the wise thing for the black man to prepare for it in every way possible, so that he does not wake up one morning, find his community entirely surrounded, and he is without weapons to fight his way out of it.
Mr. Watts.
I think for 1969, I think it's going to be the year for us to put up or shut up. And I think it's probably another way of saying what Julian has just said. I think that the white power structure, which has financed our cultural revolution in terms of, has underwritten just about every aspect of, quote, of our cultural revolution, I think they're going to say, all right, now you've had your cultural revolution. This is it. Now shut up. And at this particular junction, I think this is where we are really going to be pressed to either put up or shut up. And as I said, this gets into involved in programs, and certainly self-defense is certainly part of it.
I think we've had quite a year, to put it mildly. And I think one of the most significant events of the year that we've overlooked here in our list of of meaningful topics to discuss this evening occurred in Cleveland during the summer. See, now this said something to all of white and black America, something that Stokely Carmichael couldn't say, that the Black Panthers couldn't say, that Rap Brown couldn't say, and that Claude Brown couldn't say, and that Dan Watts couldn't say, and none of the other notables who are constantly in the public's eye via television. See, these guys can always be gotten to, but to suddenly have an unknown group, a group who hasn't been heard on nationwide TV or radio, jump up and say, okay, fellas, it's on, let's go to war with the police. And I think what this said to white America is that, look, yeah, we've heard all that rhetoric, and we've heard all the militancy and all the threats coming from that purportedly enraged black community. But, like, we've seen something this year, and what we've seen, we don't want to see this anymore. And something's going to have to be done about those black folks. And I think they're getting ready to do it. And the only way there'll be any black people around here who dare open their mouths at the end of 69, they better get ready to protect their, whatever they've got to say.
I think the Kerner...
Alice Cleveland style.
I think the Kerner Report has recognized the situation developing in America in a way that it has not been recognized before. Namely, that the nation is splitting up into two opposing camps, the so-called white camp and the so-called black camp. Now, certainly, this is a process which will continue in 1969.
You have a minute, Mr.
Hmm?
You have a minute.
Yes, the only question is, will Afro-Americans simply yield the struggle for their survival, which I don't think they will. And as a result, there will be self-defense on the part of Afro-Americans. Nobody can actually condemn people who defend themselves. And on this basis, we have to be prepared to defend ourselves. But at the same time, we must keep in mind that the best defense is not only the mobilization of our own force, but of all other forces, of all the forces around us.
What about the implications for the future? I mean, not for the future, but for the for international implications. Are there any international implications? For this whole movement toward a hardening of positions and encounter?
I think there definitely is one major, or perhaps even more, but there's one that I'm aware of, major reference to the international world, and this is in relationship to America. And this is that, you know, once I think that we can really start something here, black Americans, if we begin to get sassy, the whole world will, and say, look at what the minority is doing to that giant in that country. And then Latin America will be hard to handle, and then Asia will be hard to handle, and then Africa will be hard to handle, and pretty soon America won't look so big, man, being attacked from all corners of the world and within, too.
There's one phase of the international situation which gives some hope. It is that there was an intervention against Hitlerism. And if we do have to go through a similar phase in America, I believe there will be an intervention which would be helpful to the Afro-American.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Well, brothers and sisters, that's it for Black Journal tonight. I'm Lou House with William Greaves, and we'll be back with you on Monday,
February 24th.
Juan Gay Segay. We'll be right back.
preceding program was made possible by a grant from Polaroid Corporation and the Coca-Cola Company.
This is NET, the Public Television Network.